Lecture 76, The Vietnam War.
Vietnam was a French colony in the early 20th century. Japan invaded it in 1942, but was ousted by the victorious Allies in 1945. Ho Chi Minh, the Vietnamese nationalist leader, issued a declaration of independence based on the American model. But to his dismay, the French Empire returned, aided by the Americans, as a quid pro quo for French participation in NATO. Ho Chi Minh finally overpowered the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, and the French Empire in Vietnam ended in 1955. American power then underwrote South Vietnam, the non-communist southern half of the country, and prevented elections from taking place, which would have led to reunification under Ho Chi Minh. South Vietnam's inability to defend itself led to steady increases in American aid under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, until by 1968, over 500,000 American soldiers were fighting there. American casualties, TV footage of American troops persecuting Vietnamese villagers or accidentally bombing children with napalm turned public opinion against the war. American campuses became centers of draft resistance. Church groups campaigned against it. And in early 1968, President Johnson abandoned his re-election plans because of it. Richard Nixon campaigned successfully, claiming to have a secret plan to end the war. But after his victory that November, he showed that his determination to achieve peace with honor would postpone an end to the fighting. The last Americans withdrew only in 1973. Their absence made the fall of South Vietnam 2 years later inevitable. And the Vietnam Syndrome constrained American military actions from then on. America's defense planners became involved in Vietnam as part of the containment policy, which was central to their approach to the Cold War, and because they were determined to avoid another Munich. I mentioned earlier in connection with the Korean War that everybody had in mind the mistakes that the British and French had made in the late 1930s. Let's not appease the enemy, because if we do, the enemy's simply going to take advantage of our weakness and get stronger, and therefore we'll have to fight him later when it's much more difficult to defeat him. Better to take him on early when he's far away and weak than later when he's close and strong. Of course, Vietnam posed no immediate threat to America, but if communism spread there, it would continue to grow worldwide. Eisenhower, in a speech of 1954, coined the phrase, the idea of countries like dominoes. He said, first one domino falls, it knocks over the next one, and so on. And domino theory became one of the metaphors for thinking about the Cold War situation. Most Americans didn't know where Vietnam was, and the federal government only had about two or three employees in the 1950s who could even speak Vietnamese. Obviously, it was a tiny place very far away. America became involved in Vietnam, really, after the Second World War, in assistance to the French in the French colonial war to regain its Southeast Asian possessions, which the Japanese had overrun in 1942. And many Americans participated in this phase of the war with very bad consciences, because America's got a strong anti-colonial tradition. It had fought its own anti-colonial war to get away from the British Empire. And the idea of shoring up French colonialism was irksome. But on the other hand, the French knew how to bargain hard. They knew that the Americans wanted their cooperation in NATO, and this was the price they exacted for doing it. In 1954, the Battle of Dien Bien Phu was really the last gasp of the French army in Vietnam. The Ho Chi Minh, the leader of the Viet Minh, the guerrilla resistance forces, besieged this fortress and overran it. The French had designed it as a set piece to destroy Viet Minh power, and it had exactly the opposite effect of demonstrating to them once and for all that even with an enormous amount of American financial aid, more than $1 billion per year by then, they could no longer hold out and regain complete control of their colony. Now, an interesting thing had happened during the Second World War. Many of the peoples of Asia bitterly hated the Japanese who'd invaded their countries. But on the other hand, the invasions had shown that sometimes an Asian power can defeat a Western imperial power. And that was a lesson that they didn't forget. It didn't make them pro-Japanese, but it intensify their idea that Western imperialism was illegitimate. Well, the Geneva Accords brought the French era in Vietnam to an end, arranged that Vietnam would temporarily be divided into two zones, a north and a south, and that after a period of pacification, elections would take place. Now, the Americans at once began to aid General Diem, who was the leader of the southern half of Vietnam, and said to him, we'll help you to avoid these elections, because they could anticipate that Ho Chi Minh, who was a national hero, would certainly win the elections, and that then Vietnam would be united as a communist nation. So it was with American aid that South Vietnam remained independent. But because Diem himself was so dictatorial and so autocratic and also very corrupt, enriching himself and his family and immediate cronies, he never developed the legitimacy which a ruler needs. Most of the people of South Vietnam were completely alienated from Diem, and many of them decided to join a new guerrilla group, the Viet Cong, to fight against Diem's government in the late 1950s inside South Vietnam. The various opponent groups coalesced in 1960 into the National Liberation Front, the NLF. In other words, working for the reunification of Vietnam as a communist nation by overthrowing the southern regime with its American aid helpers. Now, in the 50s, it was still possible for Americans to be idealistic about the cause of Vietnam. The most interesting American idealist about Vietnam was a young Navy doctor called Tom Dooley. When the Geneva Accords were first made, when the French withdrew, people living in either part of Vietnam who wanted to move to the other part were able to do so. And Vietnamese Christians, Roman Catholics, who'd been converted by French missionaries in the preceding century, many of them wanted to move out of the north to South Vietnam. American Navy ships did it, and Dr. Dooley was the doctor on board one of the American ships which took northern Vietnamese Christian refugees to the south. He was horrified to discover that many of them had been tortured. And that convinced him that America had a high moral duty as the representative of the Western Christian world to prevent the fall of Vietnam to communism. And he wrote a wonderful book about it called Deliver Us from Evil, obviously a line from the Lord's Prayer. And then after leaving the Navy, he began to set up low-tech medical centers in Vietnam and Laos, in that area of Southeast Asia, bringing basic medical care to the peoples of the area who previously had often had no medical help at all. He wrote a succession of books publicizing his work, persuaded American drug companies to donate medicines to his work, and became a TV celebrity every time he was back in America on fundraising tours for this medical work. Historian James Fisher has written a wonderful book about him called Dr. America. He died very young in his early 30s of melanoma before the American mission in Vietnam had all begun to go horribly wrong. Well, Presidents Kennedy and Johnson enlarged the American presence in Vietnam. Among Kennedy's difficulties was the deep unpopularity of Diem's regime. They were parts of the Catholic minority, tainted by French imperialism because of that, and ruling very heavy-handedly. The most unpopular member of the regime was Diem's sister-in-law, the hated Madame Nu, who tried to impose Catholic principles as the civil law, even though the vast majority of the Vietnamese people were not themselves Catholics. One of the groups who led opposition to Diem's regime were the Buddhist monks. And in a series of very, very dramatic presentations, some of the monks poured gasoline over themselves and set fire to themselves in the streets of Saigon as a vivid public testimony, laying down their own lives as a way of underlining their hatred and abhorrence of Diem's regime. Now, the American military advisors in Vietnam and the American ambassador understood the unpopularity of Diem. And they also got wind of the fact that some of his generals were planning to assassinate him. And they notified President Kennedy that this assassination was planned. And after consultation with the ambassador and with his foreign policy advisors, Kennedy said, we should let the assassination go forward. And so they did. A few weeks before Kennedy was assassinated, Diem was killed. Now, of course, the Americans' hope was that he'd be replaced by someone who could gain some measure of popular legitimacy. But they were never able to find such a ruler, with the result that South Vietnam, always heavily dependent on American aid, was ruled by one after the next of usually military strongmen who did not enjoy popular support. After he'd become president, Johnson wanted to show that he was just as stern an anti-communist as Eisenhower and Kennedy had been, and as his defeated rival Barry Goldwater wanted him to be. Goldwater taunted Johnson, alleging that he was weak on communism. And so Johnson was very eager to show that that was not in fact the case. An incident in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964 provided the justification for direct American military buildup. Two American ships, the Maddox and the Turner Joy, were monitoring a South Vietnamese attack on some islands held by the North in the Gulf of Tonkin. And a North Vietnamese gunboat attacked them. President Johnson alleged wrongly that it was an unprovoked attack. In fact, it would have been the American advisors who'd mounted this whole campaign right from the beginning. Well, the attack on the Maddox and the Turner Joy prompted a resolution in the United States Senate authorizing President Johnson to use force to secure American interests in the area. All but two of the members of the United States Senate voted to give the president this discretionary power over the fighting, and President Johnson used it as authorization for the war. In private, Johnson had called Vietnam, quote, a raggedy-ass fourth-rate country. But publicly, no statements like that, of course, he wanted to project strength and anti-communist resolve, even though the place to do it was an unexpected one. And with his active approval, the American military force in Vietnam from that point on rapidly ratcheted upwards until by 1968, more than 500,000 Americans were fighting in Vietnam, whereas at the time of Kennedy's death, the number had been just 16,000. So from 16,000 to more than 500,000. Now, the American expectation of success, in one sense, was reasonable. The American military had learned a lot about long-range amphibious warfare in World War II, fighting all over the Pacific, and the island campaigns there had also introduced them to jungle warfare techniques in which American troops trained. The North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong guerrillas in the South were mainly poorly armed. They were a very, very low-tech fighting force. But right from the beginning, the Americans faced all kinds of difficulties there. First of all, they were reluctant to use too much force from fear of prompting a Chinese or Russian intervention. After all, the Korean War had gone horribly wrong when MacArthur's aggressive pursuit of the retreating North Koreans had prompted a Chinese intervention. And so the Johnson administration was very eager to make sure that that didn't happen again. So the U.S. Army wasn't given authorization to bring the war to an end through the conquering or pacification of North Vietnam. Instead, it was a holding action, which the military itself didn't like having to do because it was potentially so inconclusive, and there was no clear end to the Americans' role there. They hoped to be able to wear down the North Vietnamese army's will, but actually it was American resolve which wore down much more quickly because there was a far less vital interest at stake on the American side. Now, often what happened is that during the daytime, and especially when the American military actually showed up in one of the localities, they could control it. But at night, when the soldiers had drawn back to their bases and to the cities, the Viet Cong could take over as well. That put the ordinary peasant population of Vietnam in an extremely vulnerable situation. They had to appear to be on the side of whoever was dominant, and sometimes, literally in the space of 24 hours, that would change back and forth, depending on who was there. Also, the terrain and the enemy's fighting style made most of the American high-tech weapons unsuitable. It was impossible to use tanks in this kind of jungle warfare, for example. The Americans relied very heavily on helicopters, and that gave them an extremely high degree of mobility and temporary advantage in particular places. And they certainly inflicted far heavier casualties than they suffered because of their superiority in weapons. But what they couldn't do was permanently win the allegiance and security of large areas of the Vietnamese countryside. A historian called John Shai has made an intriguing analogy between what was happening in Vietnam in the 1960s with what had happened during the American Revolution back in the 1770s and early 80s. He said the same kinds of things were happening in both places. In many parts of the American colonies, when the British Army showed up, it could certainly intimidate the local population into the appearance of loyalty. But then, when the British Army had gone and the American Revolutionary Forces showed up, they could equally intimidate the population into the appearance of loyalty to them. And because of the latent sympathy for the revolution on the part of most of the colonists, progressively the British were unable to have control of anywhere unless they were actually right there in force. So it was an upsetting analogy because it said, we the Americans are now in the same position that the Redcoats were in back in the 1770s. But it was an interesting and important contribution to thinking about how guerrilla wars develop. You see, the American army was trained to fight battlefield wars as it had done against Hitler. Much more difficult in this case when it's not at all clear who's a friend and who's an enemy. American policymakers themselves often use the phrase hearts and minds. We've got to win the hearts and minds of the people. But in fact, they were completely unable to do so. Now, a new style of American journalism was developing at this time. It's called the New Journalism. And the new journalists cut their teeth on the Vietnam War so that a lot of very interesting reporting came out of it, in which the journalist, rather than trying to be entirely objective, describes the emotional effects of being involved in the fighting. One of the best of these accounts is Michael Herr's book, Dispatches, written in the informal style of the new journalism, including the slang of the time and the feelings of dread that he had going into combat. Here's a little passage from Dispatches. "Combat spared far more men than it wasted, but everyone suffered the time between contact, especially when they were going out every day looking for it. Bad going on foot, terrible in trucks and armored personnel carriers, awful in helicopters, the worst, travelling so fast towards something so frightening. I can remember times when I went half dead with my fear of the motion, the speed and direction already fixed and pointed one way. It was painful enough just flying safe hops between fire bases and landing zones. If you were ever on a helicopter that had been hit by ground fire, your deep, perpetual chopper anxiety was guaranteed. At least actual contact with the enemy, when it was happening, would draw long, raggedy strands of energy out of you. It was juicy, fast, and refining. And travelling towards it was hollow, dry, cold, and steady. The fear never left you alone. All you could do was look around at the other people on board and see if they were as scared and numbed out as you were. If it looked like they weren't, you thought they were insane. If it looked like they were, it made you feel a lot worse." Well, it's a great book, and it's full of these dramatic passages about the stress which everybody felt in prolonged exposure to combat. The American Army had also become familiar with battle fatigue and the way in which men in combat for too long were gradually drained of energy and drained of will. And so they introduced the principle that from the day you got to Vietnam, you'd serve there for 1 year and then leave. And so this is something which shows up in all the Vietnam movies. The men were all counting the days, counting down from 365 until the blissful day when they could leave again. Well, uncertainty about the enemy's identity, uncertainty about whether the civilian population favored them or favored the enemy or were constantly shifting side, contributed to American Commission of Atrocities, of which the best known was the My Lai Massacre. This was a shocking news story in 1969. And Lieutenant Calley, the commander of an American group, was convicted in a court-martial of ordering the killing of 200 civilians. Of course, many civilians did help the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese Army. Although atrocities like that can't be pardoned, it's understandable why the soldiers themselves should be so anxious about the uncertainty of whose loyalty lies where. Morale among the American troops dropped very, very rapidly. And one of the manifestations of this fall in morale was the way in which soldiers would kill their own commanding officers if they thought the commanders were too zealous. This was called fragging because it was possible to roll a fragmentation grenade into the tent where a zealous officer was sleeping and kill him and then disavow all knowledge of how the action had come about. There were over 700 of these fragging incidents in the late 60s and early 70s. Drug addiction also became very widespread. Vietnam is one of the areas of Southeast Asia in which the growing of powerful drugs is easy. And an enormous drug trade was going on between Vietnamese people and the soldiers and within the army as well. There were four times as many hospitalizations for drug addiction as there were for wounds in the hospitals. Of course, all this from the point of view of the high command was dismaying. Domestic opposition to the war also became widespread. Growing numbers of young men resisted the draft or deserted once they'd joined the army and been through basic training. Student deferments made it possible for you to go to college instead of going into the military, or at least, in other words, you could defer your entry into the military until after you'd gone through college. Suddenly, all kinds of people found that they were enthusiastic about higher education, and college enrollments had never been higher. But that in turn meant that people who simply could not afford to go to college had to take on a disproportionate burden of the fighting, so that the American poor, particularly minorities, were much more likely to end up in combat positions than middle-class young men from prosperous families. What was really different about the Vietnam War was that for the first time in American history, it became socially respectable to be an opponent of the war while it was going on. Big anti-war demonstrations on many campuses and in Washington enabled anti-war demonstrators to say, we're the ones taking an honorable position. We're opposing this war because it's immoral. The Americans have got no business being in Vietnam in the first place, and they're committing atrocities against the people of Vietnam. We're the bad guys in this war, and we ought not to be doing it. There was incidents like this. Girls at anti-war demonstrations carrying signs which said, girls say yes to boys who say no. That's a little play on the sexual revolution. In other words, we'll reward you for resisting the war with our sexual favors. So now this is something which had never previously been seen in American war, the idea that it was becoming that you'd get a lot of social support for not going to war. In many families, this intensified what was called in the 60s the generation gap. Because very often these are a young man of 18, his father was very likely to be a World War II veteran. And of course the mood had been so different in the Second World War, when it was your patriotic duty to go off to fight, that a veteran finding his son reluctant to do so would often be horrified by it, and they'd talk across a great gap of mutual misunderstanding. But of course, unlike World War II, it was difficult to make the case that vital American interests were at stake. The army itself was furious at being denied the chance of overall victory. On the other side, the New Left, the political organization of the student movement, was furious at the idea of the young and the poor being sacrificed in the name of abstractions thought up by old men who weren't putting themselves at risk, and especially when they didn't seem to tally with what people actually found on the ground. Eventually, 60,000 Americans died in Vietnam, and 300,000 more were wounded there. At the same time, about 2 million of the Vietnamese people died. It wasn't only the students either. At some of the American colleges, the faculty became involved as sympathizers and did what they could to help the students resist the draft in various ways. If you go to Harvard University, for example, it's very striking. When you go into the Memorial Chapel, the whole of one wall of this great chapel is devoted to Harvard men who died in the Second World War. It's a massive array of names. But elsewhere in the chapel, there's a tiny little plaque giving the names of the Harvard men who died in Vietnam. Just a little handful of them. There are high schools in small towns who had more casualties than the whole of Harvard University did. So a vivid demonstration of the way in which a place like Harvard, with all its advantages, could actually avoid the consequences of the war. Demonstrations against it attracted massive crowds, and celebrities too. Martin Luther King spoke out against the war, much to the horror of many of the civil rights people who didn't want him to dilute his energy or prestige. Dr. Spock, the author of the famous childcare book, Norman Mailer, lots of writers became passionate opponents of the war. Anti-war intellectuals like Susan Sontag and Mary McCarthy and Daniel Berrigan actually went to visit the enemy, went to visit Hanoi to see what was going on the other side of the battle lines. And sometimes they got so carried away with the idea that the Americans were wrong that they started to exaggerate the virtues of their opponent. Listen to Susan Sontag talking about the North Vietnamese. Quote, "The North Vietnamese genuinely care about the welfare of the hundreds of captured American pilots and give them bigger rations than the Vietnamese population gets. because they're bigger than we are, as a Vietnamese army officer told me, and they're used to more than we are. People in North Vietnam really do believe in the goodness of man and in the perennial possibility of rehabilitating the morally fallen, among whom they include implacable enemies, even the Americans. Well, that's dewy-eyed propaganda for the enemy at its worst, isn't it, really? Anyway, divisions inside the United States over the war prompted Lyndon Johnson to abandon his plans for re-election in 1968. He'd been anticipating running for president again. And it was the Tet Offensive early in 68 which really sealed his fate. On January the 31st, 1968, the American commander on the ground in Vietnam, General Westmoreland, had promised, quote, the light at the end of the tunnel. In other words, he said, we've now got sufficient force here in Vietnam that I can see my way clear to a resolution of the war. But yet, a few weeks later, in the Tet Offensive of the Vietnamese New Year, even the American embassy in Saigon was under direct attack. Suddenly, guerrilla forces rose up in the cities. They already controlled the countryside, now in the cities as well. And it made Westmoreland's claim of being on at the beginning of the end appear nonsensical. Actually, we now know that the Tet Offensive was a military defeat for the North and for the Viet Cong. It destroyed their infrastructure in the cities. But it certainly was an enormous propaganda victory for them because it showed that American policy wasn't making the progress that the politicians and the generals had kept implying. It contributed to a growing crisis of credibility, which took a very, very long time to disperse. It was then that phrases like this started to crop up. Don't trust anybody over 30. That was one of the slogans of the youth movement. And right up to today, we can see bumper stickers which say, question authority. That's a Vietnam-era sentiment, really. The idea that the government might routinely be lying to you about what's really going on. The election campaign of 1968 witnessed scenes of massive disruption over the war issue, especially on the Democratic side. The Democratic candidates split over whether to support a war policy at all. Once Johnson had decided not to run for re-election, his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, became the presumptive Democratic candidate. But out of loyalty to Johnson, he continued to advocate fighting the war to a successful conclusion, whereas Eugene McCarthy, who also entered the race, favored the quickest possible disengagement from the war. Late in the primary campaigns, Robert Kennedy, the former Attorney General under President Kennedy, also entered the race. And his assassination in Los Angeles just after winning the primary there added a new tragic dimension to what was already becoming a chaotic year. This was also the year in which Martin Luther King was killed, 1968. At the Democratic Convention itself in Chicago, there were great surging crowds in the streets, fights between demonstrators and the police. Mayor Daley's tough, no-nonsense cops outside the convention were beating up demonstrators, and some of the delegates inside said, we must suspend the convention while this chaos is going on around us. Well, Humphrey was chosen as the Democratic candidate, but in a weakened state because the Democratic Party was so divided over what to do about the war. Meanwhile, Richard Nixon was able to stage a comeback and nail down the Republican nomination in Miami at the same year. He claimed that he was going to bring with him the silent majority. That is, people who weren't outspoken in these very passionate days, but did believe strongly in fighting the war to an honourable conclusion. Peace talks began in Paris, but Ho Chi Minh was able to use them to delay the actual conclusion of peace, because he knew that Nixon, dedicated as Nixon was to peace with honour, certainly would not withdraw at all costs, but only under circumstances which looked favourable to American prestige in the Cold War. And Nixon's decision to widen the war into Cambodia in 1970 set off another great wave of campus demonstrations, most notoriously at Kent State University in Ohio, where National Guardsmen opened fire and killed four of the student onlookers. The outcome of the Vietnam War influenced America in profound ways. Americans didn't finally disengage from the war until 1973, although they were ratcheting down their scale of involvement rapidly after 1970. American prisoners of war returned home, although right up to the present there are people who allege that some prisoners are still being held in Vietnam and that men missing in action have never been accounted for. The Watergate crisis of 1972 through 74 and the unpopularity of the war prevented the Americans from ever returning to Vietnam, even when the North Vietnamese Army launched a conventional offensive against the South and finally overran it in 1975. And the brutal repression in the South by the communist victors after they had won led many Americans to rethink their whole approach to the war. The desperate escape of the boat people, that is Vietnamese people trying to get away from the communist regime after 75, and the even worse suffering and genocide in Cambodia, which came about in the 1970s, showed that for all the high-minded hopes sometimes attributed to them by anti-war people in America, the communist people were absolutely ruthless in enforcing their regime by force on the conquered South. American neoconservatives, notably Michael Novak and Norman Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary magazine, argued that the Americans' role had been justified after all, not least on human rights grounds. The human rights violations after the war were so severe. Here's Norman Podhoretz writing in 1976. Quote, Vietnam was the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time. When we were losing, we said we were winning. And in a desperate effort to win, we applied military force in ways that were at once brutal and inhibited, and that inspired widespread repugnance at home. But wrong as the war the US fought in Vietnam was in all these respects, it was not wrong in the purposes for which it was fought. In other words, on the big question of anti-communism, it's as necessary as ever. Well, the war had lasting consequences for American military policy right up to the present. It introduced what's called the Vietnam Syndrome, the idea that the Army needs to be very, very cautious indeed before committing itself in a foreign venture, must restrict the media's access to the theater of war very closely. In other words, it must manipulate media releases so that the kinds of scenes on American TV of the 60s don't recur. And before going into war, the politicians must be sure that they've got what's called an exit strategy. That is, the ability to get out quickly and decisively. They've concluded since Vietnam that war is going to be popular only if it's short. Also since then, the military has devoted an enormous amount of attention to keeping American casualties low. So high-tech weaponry has become a higher priority than ever. All these factors certainly operated in the Gulf War in the early 1990s, which was quick, very, very closely managed, fought to a decisive conclusion, and with very, very low American casualties. So all these factors influencing the way the Gulf War was fought can be traced back to elements of the Vietnam conflict.